Catherine Wilson, welcome to the Inquiring Mind podcast.
Thank you, Stanley.
It's such a pleasure to have you on the show. We have a lot to discuss, especially regarding your book, more latest book, How to Be an Epicurean, right? So before we get into that, how did you come to your career as a professor and a writer of philosophy?
Oh, boy, you are forcing me to think way, way back. The first philosophy book I read was Bertrand Russell's History of Western Philosophy. I just pulled it off my parents' shelf, and I was completely fascinated by it, even though I learned later that Bertrand Russell himself had it ghostwritten. He didn't actually write it himself, but it gave wonderful, witty, short sketches of everybody from the pre-Socratics to, I've forgotten where he stopped, but that really got me hooked when I was 16. And then I went and majored in philosophy in college and graduate school, did a couple of degrees, worked in Germany, worked in the UK, worked in Canada for a while. And I've been writing on philosophy since the late 70s.
And do you come from a family of academics, or did you come to it just because you had these books on your shelves?
You guessed it. Three generations.
So. Oh, wow. What did your parents teach?
They were in what used to be called physiological psychology, which meant the kind of hard science as opposed to the social science end of things. So they worked on the primate brain and perception and speech and categorization, things like that.
And you didn't catch the bug?
No, I think they were a little disappointed that I went into philosophy instead of science, because they thought philosophers just make things up. It's all just their opinion. You know, they're not really in contact with reality. But maybe that's why I went into history and philosophy of science, which is my main field of interest.
Is it true that a lot of people in the hard sciences will kind of look down a little bit on the social sciences, or is that not the case?
Yes, they certainly do. And especially physicists, you find making all kinds of scornful remarks about philosophers. I think there's more cooperation now than there used to be. For example, in philosophy biology, I've worked myself with a specialist in bees. We got interested in the question, are insects conscious? Do they have experiences? Do they have feelings? And we found that we could collaborate quite productively. Mm. And the same is true of physics and philosophers, I think.
Yeah, I first found that when I was watching the Big Bang Theory on television. It was a very popular TV show, and about these physicists at Caltech, and they were kind of they always made fun of the social sciences, and I was always wondering if that's actually the case or is it just the show. So let's start on your book. How did you come to Epicureanism, and for the audience, can you explain what is Epicureanism?
Okay. Well, back to autobiography. I was certainly not educated as an ancient philosopher. I worked on early modernity, which is 17th and 18th century. And just by chance, I think somebody invited me to a conference. In fact, I know just who it was, at the University of Toronto. And it was supposed to be about the relationship of ancient philosophy to early modern. So I thought, well, I'll just work up something on Epicureanism, because not as much has been done on that topic. And I got absolutely fascinated. And ever since, I've been writing about that topic and teaching it and trying to improve my understanding of it. So Epicureanism. I think one big difference between Epicureanism and other ancient philosophies is that it's really a theory of everything. It's got a whole physics, a whole kind of metaphysics about determinism and free will. Doesn't have so much of a logic, but it has theories of a scientific method, and it has an ethics. But unlike Stoicism, where the ethics really predominates, it's the whole package that's really important and the way in which the different strands hang together. So I think it's really important to start with the idea of the atom, which is fundamental idea. The world is made of tiny, invisible material particles. And that means the human mind is made of the same particles. Everything that exists, if there were gods, they would have to be made of little particles and be material. And nothing happens that can't ultimately be traced to the interaction and movements and behavior of these particles, which altogether make up the world. So things like color and sound and taste and odor really don't exist in the atoms themselves, but only in combination and the way they're interacting with, as the Epicureans thought, our soul atoms, which are also material. So you get this idea that the world of experience is completely different from the world that real physics would tell you about. They thought we would never see the atoms. They were too small. They didn't even have magnifying glasses, let alone microscopes or instruments. So they thought they were permanently out of reach, but that you could infer to their existence. And all sorts of consequences follow from that, because it's a very restrictive ontology, but you're getting a lot out of it.
And generally in your book, you it's almost like a comparison of Stoicism to Epicureanism. And what do you see as some of the major differences between the two? I feel like a lot of the times people maybe mistake the two or know Stoicism a lot more than they know Epicureanism. And I'm glad there's a somewhat of a revival of Epicureanism. But how is what are some of the biggest differences between Stoicism and Epicureanism?
Right. Well, we could start with some of the similarities. I think almost all Greek philosophy, Aristotle less than some other philosophers, but almost all philosophy has some kind of therapeutic function. It's supposed to be helping people to live better or be less miserable or even succeed in life. Aristotle's better on succeeding in life. But they go about it in different ways and with different presuppositions. So I think the Stoic focus is really on what do you do in a world in which things happen that you cannot control. Now, the Stoics were fatalists in a way, at least they were determinists. They thought that providence guided everything and nothing could happen otherwise than it did. And then the question was, well, how does a person cope with that realization and with the sort of the slings and arrows of fortune? Because they were aware that all sorts of adverse things can happen to people. They lose jobs, they lose money, they lose friends, people die, their ambitions are not satisfied. And the Stoic answer to that was, your mind doesn't have to be affected by those things. You can decide how you're going to feel about things. The mind is an inner citadel, as they sometimes said. It's impregnable. And once you realize that, you're not going to have any passive suffering. And they put a lot of emphasis on the virtues, which were abstract, courage and wisdom and temperance, that's in Plato. And they thought that people should, I mean, there are a lot of different Stoics, so you can't always generalize, but they believe that you should involve yourself in public life, you should have a family, you should take part in civic affairs. And some of them became very rich and very successful. Seneca, before he had to kill himself because he fell out of favor with the emperor. But coping with adversity was really the center of their philosophy. And the Epicureans were quite different because, as I was saying, they really wanted to try to understand the world. why do things happen as they do? Why does why are there earthquakes? Why are there volcanoes? Why do people fall ill? And also they wanted to understand psychological patterns. What are the effects of jealousy? Lucretius, we'll talk about the difference between Lucretius and Epicurus in a bit, but how do you prevent, what are the causes of jealousy, and how exactly could you prevent these things from happening to you? So rather than experiencing adversity and then trying to deal with it emotionally by reminding yourself that it's just the way you're perceiving the world, their advice was try to go out of the way of adversity in the first place. Avoid situations that are going to cause you trouble. Don't pursue political ambition because everybody rises and then falls. Don't pursue wealth because, you know, it's just a lot of trouble. Don't look for more than you need. Don't chase after people that aren't romantically interested in you because you'll get your heart broken. Avoidance rather than coping is their advice. Unlike the Stoics, they also thought pleasure was a good thing rather than something opposed to virtue. And that opposition between pleasure and virtue is really entrenched in philosophy. From Plato onwards, it's the opposite of virtue. Epicureans disagreed.
Well, what I find interesting is with Stoicism, and I've read a few books on Stoicism, and I had Massimo Piliucci on the podcast, but the whole dealing with suffering thing, and you know, trying to almost take yourself out of the situation, pretend like I don't know if there's a real practical application. To be honest, like I've never met a person that could truly, you know, their God forbid their loved one dies, and they could just act cool about it. You know, that it just doesn't work that way, seems to me. But there's also, I think one of Massimo's main arguments against maybe Epicureanism is the fact that people, like you mentioned, try to avoid suffering or avoid, would displeasure be the right word? But that's, can you argue that, you know, it's the old kind of motto, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, but don't people need to deal with certain amounts of adversity in their lives and kind of get over it to learn certain valuable lessons? So isn't there some kind of middle between Epicureanism and Stoicism?
Yeah, that's a good point, that unless you are kind of testing yourself against the world, you don't really know what your capabilities are. And you could criticize, and people did criticize the Epicureans for being withdrawn from public life. They really saw that as irresponsible. Why should intelligent people really just go off and form a cult by themselves, which is what the Epicureans did. So I think I tend to agree with you that you don't want to go all the way with everything Epicurus said. But back to your point that about the control of the emotions. Descartes is an interesting example here because he decided at one point that he and his letter partner, his pen pal, Princess Elizabeth, would read Seneca together because she was a very troubled person, and maybe they would find some consolation by reading this old Stoic. But then he decided Stoicism doesn't really work because when you're in an upset state, your whole physiology is disturbed. There are all these things going on with your heartbeat and your brain. Nowadays, we'd say hormones and neurotransmitters. And your mind can't just stop those physiological processes. It's just going to run. Or at least it can't stop them directly. It can only stop them by diversion, thinking other thoughts. So he decided that Stoicism was too exaggerated in what it demanded of people. And he really at one point went even further and said the emotions are the main source of pleasure in life. Without emotions, bad ones sometimes as well as good ones, we wouldn't really feel alive. We wouldn't know what we wanted to pursue and what we wanted to avoid. So trying to prevent emotional disturbance, and Stoics even thought you should prevent grief. They thought mourning was undignified. It just, one person was unfortunately dead and the other person was very sad. That's two bad things rather than just one bad thing. Compassion, they thought, was a bad emotion because one person is suffering and now you feel bad because they're suffering. You've doubled the amount of bad things in the world. Whereas the Epicurean perspective is quite different, I think, much more like the, maybe even the Buddhist one. You have to have detachment, but you also have to have compassion for people, or you don't know what you should be doing or what sorts of political policies you should be enacting. So the emotions are really important as giving you information about the world.
And with Epicureanism and Stoicism, I've seen in the last maybe 5 to 10 years, kind of a revival of these kind of practical philosophies. And I mean, there's data to support the fact that there are more and more religious nuns, N-O-N-E-S, in the United States, for sure. I'm sure it's a global trend. I think in the United Kingdom, there are almost 50% are either agnostic or atheist or something like that, or more. I might be out of date here. But does that show that there is kind of that people yearn for almost like a religious experience? Not religion necessarily, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, whatever, but some kind of philosophy to guide them through life.
Yeah, I think many people do. And I think part of it is there probably is this thing the psychologists call the God module. Something in our brains makes us prone to thinking that there are minds out there in nature that we can't see, and beings with intentions and preferences, and that this is connected somehow with conscience and morality. There's been a lot of research on that topic. And there are also experiences people have. They feel as though they're in contact with God. They feel as though God is talking to them. They feel they're preserved in their foxholes or accidents. And it's only a different kind of perspective on the world that makes you say, yes, that's just what my brain is making me think. But actually, evolution and physics and all the sciences tell us that there are not minds in nature that don't belong to human beings or animals. Those are the only kinds of minds there are. Everything comes from nature, as they used to say. But people like systems. And if religion doesn't provide them with a system, they will often look for another system. Or if not a system, just some kind of tell me what to do self-help program. Right? Because we are people who learn from other people, and we often assume they know better than we do what to do and how to live. The problem is that you can learn a lot of things from books and a lot of things from YouTube videos, from people who know how to do those things. Mm-hmm. So, but you can't really learn how to live your life from books. At least I don't think so. You might learn a few techniques, a few things that people say might jog some thoughts in you, but I think you really have to work it out for yourself, right? Standing on the shoulders maybe of people who've written things and thought about things. But the idea that you can just incorporate a ready-made system of someone else's and put it to work, that's just cultism. And I think that should be rejected. So I would really encourage people, read a lot of different philosophy. Read Epicureans, read Stoics, see what resonates with you. See what you can apply to your own life. Don't worry about being consistent or showing the other people to be wrong.
Right. Yeah. How about religious texts? Would you say that people should read religious texts?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, as I said, I don't believe in God, angels, demons, hell, or heaven, but religious texts are fascinating. And I think it's very good for everyone to have exposure, not just to their home dominant religion, but to what other religions have to say. You might be kind of appalled by some of what your own religion or the other religion says, but you need that knowledge. And you especially need to realize that these books are written by fallible human beings.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Who have their own agenda.
do you consider, obviously you just said you're not religious. Do you consider yourself, I don't want to attribute labels to you, but do you consider yourself an atheist, an agnostic, or an Epicureanist?
Yes, I'm not an agnostic, because an agnostic thinks maybe there is a God, maybe there isn't, I don't know. I'm just an atheist. But I can tell you that I had a whole religious education from age 7 or 8 up to age 17. I was in religious schools, and I'm very glad I had the experience. I learned a lot of hymns. I listened to a lot of sermons. I was in a Quaker school where we thought a lot about important things. And I think it's good to have that experience, but I don't think it's good to be indoctrinated into false beliefs about supernatural entities. I think that's really harmful. And especially harmful is the belief that what happens in this world doesn't matter, because there's a next life and a next world.
Mm. But did you experience something? Was there a moment particularly when you realized that maybe you weren't religious, or did you always kind of know that? When you went to religious school? Oh, you always knew it.
I always knew that. I think when I was 4 years old, I told my grandfather, I don't believe in God. But when I was about 10, I think, I had a momentary experience of religious conversion. I was staying in a hotel with my parents, and there was a Bible in a drawer, as there is, I think, in every hotel room in America. And I started reading this Bible. It was, I think, something about Revelation. It was really pretty scary. And for a few days there, I was completely convinced of the truth of religion, Christian religion. And then it kind of wore off. And the second time I had one of those sort of religious feeling experiences was when I had an accident, a horse riding accident, and I broke my back, and I didn't know when I was taken to the hospital whether I would ever be able to walk again. I walk just fine. I do all kinds of things. But I remember thinking, oh, please, God, let me have the use of my legs. But then that went away. So I completely understand people feeling that God helps them in times of need, or that there's something more than happens in this world. I just don't believe it myself, because I have a scientific education. If I didn't have a scientific education, I might believe quite different things.
Right. And one of the things I spoke to Massimo about was his position, because he's been very vocal about what he calls radical atheists, right? So when I was growing up, there was the Four Horsemen, Daniel Dennett, Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins, and Christopher Hitchens. And I said the same thing to him. I found Christopher Hitchens, for example, I've pretty much read all of his books, incredibly entertaining. And one of the brightest people I've ever heard. But do you think there's any utility to debating when atheists debate religious people and vice versa, or no?
Well, since religion depends on what they call faith, then by definition, it means people are not going to be persuaded by, well, the usual kinds of things, you know, a scientific account of how humans got to be on Earth. They're not going to be persuaded by geological evidence that the world was not created in 7 days. Or maybe they're going to concede certain things that the world was not created in 6 days, but they're still going to, I don't know, suppose that there might be an afterlife in which they're judged. They might pick and choose. But no, I think people change their minds, but not because someone sat down with them and you know, tried to talk them out of religious beliefs. That's not how it happens. It's that their experiences in the world cause them to lose that faith as they become exposed to other sources of information. And if you're not exposed to those other sources of information, I think the default is religion for the human species. Right. So, and unless you're just a really natural skeptic about everything.
One of the things I saw in a past discussion on, I watched one of your podcasts with Michael Shermer, and you discussed patriotism and the importance of, or the lack of importance, I guess, of patriotism and the importance of pacifism, in Epicureanism. Has, for example, in the United States, do you think there has ever been a president or somebody that kind of embodied Epicurean values, or is that contradictory? Because if you're an Epicurean, you cannot seek public office.
Well, there's a terrific book by Matthew Stewart that showed that the founding fathers were by and large Epicureans, and that if you know how to read their texts, you can see that. It's a really wonderful book. I can't exactly remember the title, but easy to find, Matthew Stewart. But I think otherwise I don't really know. Maybe I don't know as much about American presidents as I should. But I think this patriotism question is interesting. And I was thinking more about it when you sent me your questions. And I thought, well, there's maybe two kinds of patriotism. One is the my country, right or wrong, my country is the best, my country is good at everything, no matter what the statistics say. And that's really pernicious. But a good kind of patriotism is being proud of your country when it does the right thing, when it enacts sensible legislation, when it responds to people's problems, when it has an actual peacekeeping, conciliating role in the world. And you know, in general, when it does things that involve taking a stand that may be difficult, but that are beneficial to humanity or the citizenry, then you can be proud of your country that it has taken that stand. And that's good patriotism.
But isn't that nationalism rather than patriotism? Because I remember there's a really good book written a couple of years ago by Jonah Goldberg, no relation, called Suicide of the West. And he's more of a traditionally a conservative, but he talks about, for example, nationalism, right? And nationalism, he compares it to salt, right? A little bit of salt in a meal enhances the meal. Not enough makes it bland, and too much literally can kill you. So what you describe with being fanatic about your country and whatnot, and, you know, thumping your chest and saying we're the greatest, even though you're not doing anything, that's, I guess, too much salt. But patriotism, traditionally, I mean, as far as I understand, I don't know the literal definition, is just appreciation and love of your country. But you could still criticize your country, and if you disagree with some policy or whatnot, you have the right to speak your mind. But that's all patriotism means. I think when you go beyond that and start, you know, the chest thumping, that becomes nationalism. And there are people that argue that nationalism actually could be good, but that's a whole separate, you know, can of worms. But would Epicureans technically consider patriotism or nationalism? Were they patriots or nationalists or neither, because they didn't see the value in having borders or whatnot?
I would think that they would say, maybe I'm reading my own opinion in here, but that a country is not an object you can love or not love. What is a country? Well, it's a bunch of people and it's a bunch of institutions and laws that have changed over time. It's a certain delimited piece of land that has boundaries. None of those things are as such lovable. You can love a person, you can love a pet, you can maybe love your work, I suppose, if you're very happy doing it. But about where countries are concerned, there's nothing to love.
I mean, but countries are a collection of people, pets, and all of that. So can't you argue that you can love all of them together?
Yeah, but patriots don't. Patriots have an awful lot of people they claim to hate. So they're certainly not loving the population of their country.
Again, wouldn't you say, again, patriot, or do you mean people outside of the country or people within the country?
Within the country. Yeah. I mean, all these new patriot movements are very phobic about lots and lots of citizens of the U.S.
But again, isn't that, again, I guess this is a matter of definition. Maybe they're misconstruing the word patriotism because nobody, I think most people are smart enough, I would hope, to not join some kind of, you know, I don't know, America for Nationalism rally or something like that, American Nationalist rally. But when it comes to, you know, something, well, even the way we name some of our bills in the United States, like the Patriot Act and all of that, it's all meant to build people's trust and say, oh, okay, it's a Patriot Act. So it's kind of disarming a little bit. But for the most part, for example, I mean, I consider myself a patriot of, you know, the United States. I was born here. My parents came from somewhere else. I have a decent life. I have opportunities. And I know that this country has provided a lot of opportunities to a lot of people. So I can honestly say I don't hate any group of people or anything. Only if I encounter somebody on the street do I feel like I might dislike somebody because they're mean or they're rude or whatever. But for the most part, I have no prejudice towards anybody. And I consider myself a patriot. Do I feel like the United States as a whole maybe has enemies abroad? Yeah, for sure. I mean, there are people that wish ill on the United States, but that's what I would consider my enemies, I guess. But I feel like the people that really, you know, America is for Americans or whatever that means, and they don't like a lot of subsects of their own population, that's bordering on nationalism rather than patriotism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think you might say there are lots of things to admire about what America has done over the several hundred years that it's been in existence. It has stood up for the rule of law. It was one of the first countries, if not the first country, to really take equality seriously. It also, when the rest of Europe was quite snobbish and backward, it provided for opportunity. And there's a lot of social mobility at one point. I think we've really gone backwards on social mobility. And certainly in the last administration, we went backwards on rule of law. So those things that one could admire about an earlier America were really, really threatened. And that's what makes me suspicious about modern patriots, that they tend to think it's rather a good thing that rule of law and equality were getting rolled back. And about equality of opportunity, they weren't very concerned.
Yeah, one of the factors thing you're just talking about, I always feel like it's a lack of education in the United States. It's not, we don't teach history very well, unfortunately. And I've encountered way too many people to tell me that tell me history is boring, which I never quite understood, because it's almost impossible to make boring, but I guess some teachers and some people can manage to do that. And I think you're going to have these kind of movements and these kind of people that distort history or whitewash it. If we don't have enough of a population that understands the context, right? And that kind of brings me to another point that I found very interesting. Do you believe that people should judge, for example, an issue like slavery based on our modern conception of slavery or on a kind of a past, and be fair to the people of the time and be like, maybe they're just products of their time?
Yeah, those are really interesting questions. As you know, I wrote a bit about the teaching of history in the book, and I completely agree with you that it's taught badly and it's made to be boring when it's not boring at all. When I was in school, there was the history of kings and queens and battles and treaties. And there was a lot of memorization and dates, and it really was not very interesting. But when it's taught as social history, that is absolutely fascinating, I think. What were the relations between people? What were they eating? Well, how did they furnish their houses? How were they interacting with each other? What did they do for games and sports? And what were they reading? That's all really, really interesting to anyone of any age. And we really need to revise the curricula. And this is important for moral reasons too, because people need to know, how have institutions changed? How did people treat each other in the past? So that takes me to your other question about absolute versus relative moral standards. I think there are really two ways to look at it. One is, what could people at the time have known, given what the state of discourse and debate was? If nobody, for example, was resisting slavery or arguing philosophically that slavery was a bad idea, it's sort of hard to see how just one person could come up with that idea by themselves and be right. So slavery was absolutely taken for granted in ancient times. As Aristotle said, how's the work going to get done if we don't have slaves? The fields don't mow themselves. And so this gradual learning process where humanity, by experience and trial and error, came to decide that slavery was a bad thing. That took thousands of years for people to figure out, even though there were a few voices along the way. So on one hand, you can be kind of sympathetic to people who just didn't know. In the 50s, it was considered perfectly okay for bosses to seduce their secretaries, and for people to treat their underlings as slaves. And now we don't accept that anymore. The newspapers are full of people suing their employers and instructors for bad behavior. And again, you can take a somewhat sympathetic perspective on that if you want and say, well, nobody was questioning that. People thought it was normal, or they didn't talk about it. So how were people supposed to know? The other perspective you can take on it is to say, in absolute terms, the behavior was always wrong because it was always taking advantage of the vulnerability of others. And that's what an affront to morality is, having power over somebody, being able to manipulate them or get them to please you because you're in a position of power or authority. And that gives you an absolute standard. So I think we operate and we have to operate with both sets of standards, even though they give opposite answers to all of these questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, one of the things, for example, let's touch on the gay marriage debate in the United States, right? Barack Obama ran for president in 2008, and he was not for gay marriage. He never made it explicit that he was against it, but he wasn't going to touch it. Then it becomes, I guess, socially acceptable to be for it, and there's a Supreme Court case, and et cetera, et cetera. And all of a sudden, all of these people that claim they were never for gay marriage become for gay marriage. I'm actually quite sure that most of them were for it in their minds, but they couldn't say it politically. But should we judge them for saying what they said? Because maybe they were just a product of their time, right? People grow up in different at different times. And for example, I'm pretty much positive that when I have kids, my kids are going to look at me and be like, well, dad, you know, that's not exactly the right idea to have at the moment, you know, because things evolve, like you just mentioned, and people's minds change about a bunch of things. And it's not socially acceptable one day, and then all of a sudden it becomes socially acceptable. And I think in the United States, I mean, considering that our history is just 250 years or thereabout, there's been a lot of change that's happened in that time. So, you know, we had slavery, then we didn't have slavery, you know, Jim Crow, no Jim Crow, all of these things that changed in the span of a few decades in reality, right? So there is a general conversation in the United States, for example, where people do judge George Washington or Thomas Jefferson for having slaves. And I sit back and I go, yes, there was, for example, John Adams that spoke out against slavery, was very anti-slavery. But he wasn't the most he didn't have the most popular opinion in the room. So makes me have some sympathy for George Washington or Thomas Jefferson. I kind of understand them. I don't excuse if they, you know, beat their slaves or whatnot, but it's almost weird to say that I kind of understand where they were coming from, because slavery is a universal thing. It's not just the United States. The whole world had slaves at any given point. So yeah. I think the real accomplishment is the fact that we, you know, kind of got over that moment in history.
Yeah. And you can say slavery was always wrong, torture was always wrong, but when it comes to judging individual people for whether they were bad people for doing that, then you have to take what they could have known and what their motivations were into account. And that may give you more sympathy for them or less. I'm not sure that I would think, even if torture was ubiquitous in the Middle Ages up till about the 17th century, that I wouldn't think that torturers were bad people. I probably would think that.
Are they bad people, or are they just products of the job they do?
Yeah, they're products of the job they do, but...
There's a really good book by Christopher Browning called Ordinary Men. It's about, well, quite literally, ordinary men. They were police officers in the Einsatzgruppen, right? So they led the Eastern Front along. And these people who were like police officers and just regular people ended up committing such atrocities to other fellow human beings. They killed crazy amounts of people. And a lot of them did have reactions. So they would shoot these automatic weapons and they would throw up. And that book really got me thinking, do I blame them for what they did? Maybe this is an unpopular opinion, but do I blame them for what they did, or is it a product of what they had to do? And in some ways, maybe they got talked into it. They were brainwashed. It's very difficult. Human nature is so hard to capture, because on one hand, we're capable of doing some really great things and innovation, tech, you know, people working and technological innovation, whatnot. And then on the other hand, you can commit mass atrocities and mass murder to your fellow human beings. There are pernicious people. I wouldn't argue, for example, I'm never going to sit back and be like, well, I kind of understand Hitler's point of view. I don't. But there are people within the Nazi regime, for example, or under Stalin's Soviet Union, right? So people committed these atrocities, but I don't know. I can't tell you that they're bad people. I could just tell you what they did was horrible.
Right. Yeah. So from an absolute point of view, killing people for ideological reasons, you would say, is always wrong. Killing them because they're communists is wrong. Killing them because they're Jews is wrong. Killing them because they're homosexuals is wrong. All those things. And yet, as you say, we can understand the psychology of people who, either because they've been forced to be obedient, as in a military situation where they'll be court-martialed if they disobey orders, or because they're just naturally subservient to authority, will do things that they wouldn't do under other circumstances. I think it's in that same book, there's an interesting discussion of opting in versus opting out. It's very hard. I think the example was some general orders the soldiers to shoot all the women and children of the village they're in. And he asks if anyone will opt out from doing that. Nobody does, or very few people. But if the question had been asked, would you like to opt in and shoot all these women and children? None of them would have opted in. So it's that problem of authority. And that's why I'm very suspicious of patriotism, because I think it makes people do bad things for the sake of this total abstraction, namely kill other people and destroy their possessions for the sake of some ideal. And Epicureans don't believe in doing things by and large for abstract ideals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so maybe to pivot a little bit, I touched on this subject with Massimo as well. I mentioned the fact that I feel like there is a hero, quote unquote, deficiency in the United States. I'm not going to speak for other countries because I don't know, but you know, we're in the process. You know, we experienced a lot of statues being torn down. Maybe some people, if you legally did it, I'd be okay with it. But for example, Lincoln statue, Ulysses S. Grant statue was torn down in some places. And it got me thinking, I think it showcased a lot of historical ignorance among the population of people that did this. And two, it got me thinking about who the country looks up to, or does a country need somebody to look up to? And I think when I was growing up, not that long ago, I guess, because I'm very young, but I remember going to Washington, D.C. as a kid and seeing all these monuments and being in awe, because I was learning American history and it's interesting. And in my mind, these people were my heroes. Lincoln was a hero of mine, still is. Jefferson in some ways. John Adams is a hero of mine, but I feel like most people, they have their personal idols or role models, but I think countries do need somebody to look up to, and you can't denigrate past generations, because you know, it's going to be one of those situations where you denigrate somebody for long enough, and then you get of a certain age and the generation under you will denigrate you for something you did. And I think it's a slippery slope. So do you think countries, or what's the importance of heroes in society?
I think as long as Kant pointed out that you get statues in every village or every town square for someone whose claim to fame was that they slaughtered hundreds or tens of thousands of people. An awful lot of our statues are statues of conquerors, generals and kings and people whose claim to fame is winning battles, victories, and defense of the fatherland. If instead we had our statues, writers, artists, scientists, politicians, educators, that would be fantastic. Those are the people that we should be looking up to.
Yeah, I remember David McCullough, the great historian, was talking about just that. He was saying that in every town square, there should be a statue of a very good teacher or something like that. And honestly, I generally agree. I think for the most part, a lot of the Confederate statues that I was referring to earlier are of generals, General Lee, General and others. But I don't see personally Lincoln or Grant. Grant was a general, but he was also a president. As conquerors, they're just great leaders during their time. So do you think those people should have statues, or is it, and I agree, by the way, I completely agree with you that we should have more statues of, again, the educators and maybe some politicians, but definitely writers. I think writers would be great, because I don't know. I feel like I always walked up to statues and read the little label that they had and was like, oh, who's this guy? So I think it would be a good like educational resource for people.
Yeah. Of course, there's the tricky case of people who liberated their country from tyrants who were murdering other people. And should they get a statue?
Churchill, for example, right? Like Churchill in England would be a good example of that.
You make some exceptions.
Right. I think one of the main questions I look for answers in books about Stoicism, Epicureanism, is what makes and what constitutes a good life? And I think that's all subjective, but there are some general principles that people can apply to perhaps live a better life. How do you think, and you don't have to just say Epicureanism, how can we apply Epicureanism or other philosophies? And in your opinion, what constitutes a good life or a meaningful life?
Well, I think that's really subjective, a really subjective matter, that there's no general formula, that a meaningful life is one that feels meaningful to you, that you feel that your abilities, your interests, your strengths and weaknesses are being realized. You're not frustrated by not being recognized for things that you do well, or not being able to develop a talent that you really enjoy. As long as you're doing things that feel like you, your life feels meaningful. So I don't think you have to be heroic or, be Mother Teresa and engage in public service. Or, as I said in the book, you don't have to win prizes or amass a fortune or do anything. It's all about how you are engaging with the world moment by moment. And Epicurus says one of the greatest enjoyments is not just eating and drinking and things like that, but learning about the world. And I think that's what keeps life fresh and interesting for people, is the thought that there are always new things to see and think about and learn about and figure out. And when you're doing that, you feel in touch with the world as though you belong there rather than alienated from it. what makes people really miserable and alienated are bad jobs, especially bad bosses, having to be subordinate to someone that you don't like, don't have respect for, doesn't appreciate you, and bad relations in the family or bad relations with partners. That's
and where alienated. Where does how about external factors? So a lot of people want to achieve what they define as success, a lot of money, a big house, nice cars. Where does that feature in a meaningful life or a good life?
Yeah. Well, you need enough to satisfy you. Having too little space in a house is very unpleasant. No. I don't know how many square feet a person needs to feel well, but crowding is awful. But most things, and having a car that you can depend on, that you enjoy driving, that's important too. You can't get along in many places without one. But the idea that you will be happy if only you get such and such a house or such and such a car, people quickly find out that that is not the case. They get the house and the car, and 2 months later, they're back to where they were in terms of satisfaction with life. So I think it's a matter of experimentation, finding out what you actually enjoy. If a really big house gives you constant pleasure, or the really expensive car that you sacrifice to buy, you just love driving it, good, okay, as long as you're not depriving anyone else. But people amassing these vast fortunes that they can't possibly spend just to have more money than the next person, that's what's really unconscionable. So I do not understand U.S. tax policy at all from that perspective.
But even spending the money, sometimes my best friend and I were doing a kind of a thought experiment, and I said, you know, if somebody gave you a blank check and said, whatever you want, anything you've ever wished for, here's the money, no worries, right? And we started thinking about what we actually want. And it's actually quite funny that it was maybe one or two things. We said house, and well, he said car. I'm not a big car guy. If it's functional, it's fine. But it's interesting that human beings think they need more than they actually need. Mm-hmm. You know, we fantasize about them having a few million dollars, but then you think about it and you go, what do you actually need it for? Right. Sure. You don't need it. What are you going to go buy some fancy clothing? I mean, maybe, but for the most part, it doesn't bring much value past a certain point.
Right. Yeah. There are thresholds. You've got to get above the threshold to have a decent life, but you don't need to go above mm-hmm. a higher threshold to have a very happy life in which you are perfectly satisfied.
Right. So I kind of want to leave this towards the end, but the depressing topic, how does Epicureanism view death? And how is that different from, I mean, we discussed a little bit about how the Stoics view it. And personally, I'm not a huge fan of how they discuss death, but how about Epicureans?
Yeah. Well, death is inevitable, and it's the end. There's no afterlife. I'm not sure what the Stoic position on that is, but for the Epicureans, your soul atoms just dissipate into the universe, and you become part of something else later on, but it won't be you. So they say if you've lived your life in an enjoyable and maybe in your terms a meaningful way, you can leave the party, as they put it, without too many regrets when you start to feel that you're no longer able to do the things that brought you pleasure. So you become very old and frail and all that, you shouldn't mind, you know, the long sleep that is death. On the other hand, they really disapproved of the Stoic idea that there was noble suicide, that if you suffered political defeat or lost your fortune, you should just kill yourself because that was the noble thing to do. They say, no, you really just wait. It seems really bad now, but remember you were happy in the past and you will be happy again. It doesn't seem like it now, but you will be. And 99% of the time they're right about that. What they find somewhat incomprehensible is the very old, very debilitated people who just cling to life in a kind of selfish manner. And of course, society is having a lot of debates now about end of life planning, assisted suicide. And I think people are coming around to the idea that it might be perfectly all right just to decide you've had enough, that the pain now outweighs the pleasure. You're no longer able to communicate with people, to enjoy a meal, to understand what you're seeing on TV. And if treatment is withheld from you, that is perfectly fine.
There's a really good book by a physician named Atul Gawande. He wrote a book called Being Mortal. It's about geriatrics and whatever. It was a very popular book, but one of the things he changed my mind on is how people view the end of their lives and the importance of feeling like you could still do something. So for example, he mentions one of the anecdotes in the book, I'm sorry if it takes a little bit to recall, it's been a while, was this man that he was asked the question, like, what would bring you meaning or happiness in life at this point? He had terminal cancer. He was probably going to die. He goes, as long as I could sit down, watch my football game, have a beer, that's fine. That brings me happiness. So I think for a long time, especially medicine, was how can we treat this person, but not how can we actually care for this person and make sure that they're okay. And when it's all said and done, they actually had a, you know, they died around their family, if that's what they value, not in the hospital bed. And the assisted suicide conversation is part of that, because if some people are just suffering and they're on life support and they don't want to waste resources or money or just suffer more than they have to, and they go, you know what, it's my time, just pull the plug, you know? So I think people really, I really hope so, but I think people are really coming around to that kind of thought process. And how can we alleviate suffering in the last days of some people's lives? That was very sad, but I like to kind of wrap up my podcasts, especially with the last, with the last year being the way it was with the pandemic. A lot of people were very sad and depressed very often, but what gives you hope for the future?
Lots of things. The world was looking pretty dire for a while, and still there are a lot of alarming things happening. Myanmar, Russia, a lot of repression, and dissatisfaction, and global warming, and these things are all connected. But what gives me hope, I think, is that the world is waking up to the climate crisis, and things are going to get done. Especially in the US, we have wonderful proposals now for infrastructure in the broadest sense, social as well as material. Nobody really expected this from Biden, but it's definitely happening, and we just hope he can get most of that through. I think the youth of the world is awakened to its problems and has become very energized instead of politically passive and thinking, oh, politics is just a bunch of old guys and there's no difference between them and there's no point in voting because no, it's not going to make any difference. We've seen the difference that the youth vote makes. And young people have been really well educated, I think, in critical theory, something my generation missed. So they have a much better awareness of how the world works and how power relations work. All of this gets criticized a lot by the conservative press, but of course, I think it's been terribly progressive. So I'm more hopeful now than I was 2 years ago that things are going to improve.
Well, great. So let me ask a few more questions. Another question that I like to ask at the end, because I mean, the reasoning behind this next question is when I was watching podcasts, you know, before, and I still do, and I listen to somebody that I find incredibly interesting, I always want to know, what are they reading? What is something that changed their lives or that brings them the books that brought them a lot of value? So what are five books, feel free to name more if you want, that you would recommend to anyone on any topic?
Okay. Yeah.
Fiction or nonfiction, by the way. So,
yeah. Well, I came up with four nonfiction books that I really enjoyed and one fiction book. And I don't know if these are the greatest books ever written in their field, but they're ones that I really got a lot out of. So one was called The Daily Life of the Aztecs by Jacques Soustelle. Mm-hmm. And it's just an anthropological description of how these people were living in our medieval times and the sophistication of their culture and how they conducted their marriage ceremonies and what they ate and what they wore. And that's a really wonderful book. Another one I'd recommend is Freud, The Future of an Illusion, which is about religion and Freud's idea of how the Judeo-Christian religion came into being. It's kind of an eccentric theory, but it's very good on the topic of philosophy of religion. Another book I really enjoyed, but it sort of left me in tears, was Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee by Dee Brown, about the US Army and the extermination of the American Aboriginals. And that was really fascinating, just kind of changed the way I thought about history. In the novel category, Kazuo Ishiguro is a great favorite of mine. I love his writings. I think Never Let Me Go, which was made into a film, was one of his best, if not his best. And of course, I have to recommend the Epicurean Lucretius's The Nature of Things as a great didactic poem.
Fantastic. So to wrap up, what are you currently working on? I don't know if there's a book in the pipeline or ideas you're thinking about, and how can people follow your work?
Yes. Well, I'm just finishing a book on Kant and the 18th century, which will be about the Enlightenment, politically, socially, scientifically. There's a fair amount of social history in it, also history of science, and how Kantian metaphysics and morality interacted with those social movements and scientific developments. So it's a new kind of Kant book because Kant is usually treated in this very minute textual fashion, and I've gone for the big picture. So I'm really, I think, quite easy to find on the web because I try to post my articles on academia.edu or ResearchGate. And anything anybody wants to see, if they shoot me an email, I can send it to them. I think Google Scholar lists most of my things as well. So I'm fairly easy to find for anyone who knows how to spell my name.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It was a great conversation. Look forward to doing it again in the future.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it too. You had great questions.
Thank you.